Hi, everybody. We're live.
Hello. Sorry, I was catching the boys up on some stuff, so which we may or may not talk about in the after show. We'll see. But the delay
as an aside for a part that people didn't hear, can you explain to me what heat tape is?
Casey,
well,
or me?
What I think it is. Maybe I'm wrong, but I can tell you what I think it is.
I honestly have no idea. Anyone, please tell me.
Okay, so this relates to an HVAC problem that I had a couple of days ago that is sort of kind of still ongoing. But suffice to say, heat tape is what I know as the colloquial term. Maybe it's a proprietary eponym. I don't know. But to answer your question, it's a thing that you plug in to a normal outlet, and it's very, tape is a misnomer. It's a very, very thin piece of, I don't know how to describe it. It's such a simple question. It's like, it's a little strip that you zip tie to PVC piping in order to make sure that whatever's in that pipe doesn't freeze over. So this tape warms up, and since it's pressed up against the PVC pipe, the theory is that whatever liquid, presumably water, that's in the PVC will not freeze because the heat tape is actually warming up that pipe, if that makes any sense at all, and perhaps
is it sticky like tape?
Well, the one that was installed in our house was not, or at least I don't think so, because it's zip tied every like 6 inches or whatever, which is what, like 10, 12 centimeters. I don't know. Metric. How does it work? But anyways, it's at, like every 6 inches it's taped. Actually, you can see it in the photo. I'm not going to share this publicly, I don't think, but you can see the photo that I sent you to. There's a piece of PVC and there's like a black thing dangling off of it, not from the top, from the bottom. That's the heat tape.
Yeah, the thing from the top is, like, just holding the pipe up.
Correct,
right?
Correct.
And that thing, so it's running lengthwise? Yeah, I see what
yes.
it is. Yeah.
All right. Sorry, and I apologize for not really, I'd rather not share this particular photo publicly.
People are going to hatch your house.
Listeners.
They're going to find vulnerabilities.
Well, I don't know. It's just some,
they're
going to
see water intentionally leaking into your crawl space.
Yeah, exactly. I don't need the commentariat to come after me for all the different problems with my house. I am Team John on that. I am blissfully ignorant. Let's stay that way. Anyway, do we actually have a pre-show, or was that the pre-show?
I have rejoined the winter tire lifestyle, sort of.
Oh, in the i3?
That's right. So over the weekend, Tiff had taken my car out of town because it has a long range, and I was driving her car, the i3. My car, the iX, is
perfectly well
in the snow.
I meant to say iX. I 100% said i3, but I was...
And i3 is the one that has a range extender.
That's right. But it's still, you know, to go, like, you know, deep upstate, it's not super great. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so she had my good car, and I had the i3, which is a wonderful car in lots of ways. However, I learned that in snow and ice, it is not only not a wonderful car, it is a horrendously bad car in snow and ice.
It ever had its tires changed? Ever?
It only has like 11,000 miles on it. Mm. But
so these are the original tires. What year was this car?
Not anymore. There was like a slow leak in about a year ago. Maybe there was a slow leak, and they determined let's replace all of them because they had worn enough by that point that that's like, might as well do it. So they're actually fairly new tires. The problem as if you look into i3 owners and their experience of driving it in the winter, so it is a rear-wheel drive car, which, you know, I've had rear-wheel drive cars before. I know how they handle in the snow, which is not amazing. Badly. But, yeah, but, you know, if you have snow tires, you can do okay. It's still, you know, way worse than an all-wheel drive car, even with regular all-season tires. But, okay. Don't at me.
It's way worse than front-wheel drive, too, by the way.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Can I just stop you right there?
Yeah.
I don't particularly disagree with you, but the snow tire zealots are going to come for you.
Good
they
for
will
them.
Argue.
I've
they will
been
argue.
There.
I just want to acknowledge this mm-hmm. argument because I'm not interested in pursuing it further after this moment. I acknowledge, and I am acknowledging on behalf of all three of us until John argues with me, that I understand that with the right set of snow tires, a rear-wheel drive car is actually very performant in the snow. I agree with Marco, though, for an average driver, which I include myself in that, it is probably better to have an all-wheel drive car in the snow than a rear-wheel drive car, rear-wheel drive car with snow tires.
Yes.
Especially where I am. And I am not interested in having an argument about this anywhere on the internet. Please
nope.
and thank you.
Yeah. That is my assertion.
If you have an all-wheel drive car with like summer performance tires on
it,
it's
there.
Not
yep.
going to be better.
Been there.
Well,
it's not
right.
good.
Yeah, but yeah, my assertion is merely that all-wheel drive with all-season tires is better than rear-wheel drive with no tires. Anyway.
And people will argue with you.
I know.
I'm not interested in the argument, everyone. Thank you, but no thank you.
Yeah. Anyway, and to clarify, I'm talking about winter tires, not snow tires, technically. Thank you, everybody. Okay. So anyway, driving Tiff's car in the snow and ice over the last few days, I messaged her. I'm like, can I please buy you snow tires? So, because the problem is the i3, yeah, it's rear-wheel drive. The tires that are, so the i3 has very narrow tires. It's like, it's basically motorcycle tires, even narrower than many motorcycle tires. It looks like bike tires almost. Like,
it's like
for
a big
car.
Roller skate. The good thing is when it spins, since the wheelbase is so short, you can't even tell when it's going forward or backward or sideways.
Yeah. So anyway, and the tires that are on it are like eco range maxing tires, which are not good for traction in the winter. They're not optimized for that. They're optimized
for roller skate. Yeah, real hard tires. Yeah.
Yeah, they're optimized for range in the summer, which is fine, but not what we need. So I'm finally, went to tire rack, place an order. Like, there's one snow tire that is made.
Yeah, I was going to say, who makes snow tires that small?
There is one on the. I think it's a Blizzak. There's one currently on the market that fits it. And if
you
look like
the tire size,
no, but it's very. I mean, I
guess, what's the wheel size? It's like 16 inches.
I can tell you. Hold on, my order has shipped.
As someone pointed out online recently, I know we talked about tire sizing in context of the bootleg thing, and we went through the tire sizing. And a thing that had never occurred to me until someone just pointed out recently is that tire sizing mixes metric, imperial, and proportion in the same size.
So the tire size, by the way, the tire size. So the regular tire size for the vehicle stock is actually staggered, but for the snow tires, it's square. And the tire size for the snows is 155/70R19.
19 inch? That's 19? Way bigger than I thought it would be.
Yeah, seriously. I'm very surprised. The 155
is millimeters. Is millimeters. Then the 19 is inches. And then the other number is 70R. Sidewall height as a proportion of the width, I believe.
Yeah. Right. So I assume 155 is fairly narrow for a car?
Yes.
It's very narrow. 19 is way bigger than I would have guessed.
Yeah, and actually, having just had to replace one of Aaron's tires, which is a whole story, I forget what that was, but I want to say it was like 275. I can look that up as well, and I'll get back to you in a second. But it was quite like two or three times. It was like twice the size of what you're talking about. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, so anyway, here's hoping that rejoining the snow tire, winter tire lifestyle will improve this car in the snow for the rest of its useful life in our household.
Here we go. 275, 40. R21.
There you go. Yeah, and your neighbors thank you, Marco, for guaranteeing a mild winter now that you bought new snow tires.
Yeah, I recharged the snowblower. It's my snowblower, it's like one of those like Aaron's two-stage. It's a good snowblower, but it has something about it that's electronic. I think it might be fuel injection or something. And so it has a battery in like the main control deck that you have to plug a special cable in and charge approximately every 2 years, which is a long enough span that I never remember that it's there. And so it just seems every 2 years like, oh, my snowblower won't start. Oh, crap. I got to get this thing fixed.
It's probably the battery for the starter would be my guess, right?
No, the starter, you have to like plug an electric cable into it for the starter. But it's kind of like, it's almost like a USB voltage charger, but into like a special, looks like a 2-pin Molex kind of connector. You got to like disconnect this cable, plug this 2-pin Molex adapter into it from the special adapter that comes with it. And it's not labeled at all, and there's three different cables under that look like it. Like it's very unintuitive. I think it's like electronic, I don't know, valve timing or something, spark.
The Vano system on your snowblower.
Yeah, I don't know. God knows. I don't know anything about engines. But yeah, every 2 years I have to try it, but I never, and sure enough, I'm like trying to start it up and looking around like, does it have one of those little like squish things you push to put some fuel in them? No, it doesn't have one of those. I'm looking around. Why isn't it starting? And I guess I got to call a service center. I'll do it tomorrow. And then like a day later, I remember, oh yeah, there's a battery.
Nice.
Anyway, it's not a very funny story.
So you got the snow tires and is the car, or you put them on? Have they been mounted?
Not yet. Getting there at the end of the week, hopefully.
All right. All right. Well, Godspeed in your travels. I hope it goes well. It's funny you bring this up. So my friend Brad that lives here, he has an F-150 Lightning that he adores. And we recently got news that Ford is killing the Lightning, the full BEV Lightning. And they're going to basically a i3 Rex equivalent. So the whatever.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so whatever's replacing it will be fully electric drivetrain, not unlike your i3, but it will have a range extending, you know, gasoline engine in order to help with towing, with heavy loads, and just range extension. And it's funny because Brad and another friend of mine, Bill, the two of them both have Lightnings and are not happy about this because they would much rather stay full electric rather than, you know, doing this range extending thing. But I've been explaining, like, you know, hey, there's perks to the range extending thing. That's what the i3 is, you know, and so on. So that's why I had i3 on the brain earlier when I said i3 instead of ix. It's because I was just talking to my friends about this recently, which is kind of funny.
Yeah, it's really, it's a shame.
This is being rebranded as, not to continue this tangent longer, but I love how this is being rebranded as range extending and not, quote unquote, not hybrid. I have news for you about a lot of current hybrids. They work exactly the same way. I mean, we just got done talking about almost exactly the same way. Like the Honda's new hybrid system is essentially the engine runs a generator. The generator powers an electric motor powers the wheels. The only exception is that there is like a fifth gear size ratio in which you can also couple the gas engine to the wheel at highway speeds. But that's it. All of the driving is 100% electric. But anyway, yeah, your friends should have bought, I guess, 10,000 more F-150 Lightnings each to keep the yeah. keep the product line in business. I guess I should have bought more Mac Pros.
Right? All right. Well, it's sad times for the Lightning owners. I mean, I get it. The truck is... It's the perfect truck for my friends, but for most pickup buyers, I think
it's not great as a truck. Well, that's true of a lot of trucks, but this one particularly so.
Yeah. So... Anyways, all right, let's do some follow-up. And we have another.
No.
Oh, God, see, we did it. I did it.
You didn't remember the gift thing. It was your idea.
I know. Wow. Well, so before we even got the bootleg going, John pointed out to me, hey, I didn't do what I've done the last few times and put the gift memberships and member special announcements in like garish font colors or background colors so I would remember. And he said, I didn't do that this time. Let's see what happens.
So it was a
sure
test.
Enough,
it was a test. You failed that test.
I have failed it miserably. Let me try that again. We're not going to fix this in post because why bother?
No, we'll fix it in post. We're going to cut a lot of this stuff out in post. But before that, Casey, look above it. One line above the thing that you put in.
Yes, the thing that I put in. All right.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Let me give you a clean edit just in case you do fix it in post.
Oh my God.
All right, so it is nearly Christmas as we record this. It is the 17th of December. Hanukkah is actually going as we speak. And if you are in the gift-giving mood and you have a nerd in your life that perhaps listens to the show, which maybe you do too, hopefully that's how you're hearing this message. Anyways, if you have a nerd that you want to gift a membership to, remember that thanks to the hard work of one John Syracusa, ATP gift memberships are a thing, and you can actually gift somebody an entire membership for, I believe, John, and jump in here, a month, a year, maybe even forever. No, not forever. But there is all sorts of different things you can do with gift memberships. John, how does this work?
Well, the thing you need to know is you go to atp.fm/gift. That's the URL for you. I added some more instructions there. If you go to atp.fm/store, I also put the gift instructions there. But yeah, you can buy a month or a year. You can buy multiple months. You can buy multiple years. It's all explained in the fact. It's been a pretty solid system. People have been using it, and it has been working for them, and we haven't really had any problems. The only wrinkle is that, obviously, to buy something, you have to create an account so you can give payment through our payment processor and stuff like that. You're led through it on the page. ATP.fm/gift will explain it all. And then they have to put in your email address if you're the one who wants the gift or something. So there's like a URL that's like ATP.fm/gift ?4 equals your email address. It just pre-fills the form. But don't worry, if they enter the wrong email address, we can even fix that after the fact. So we've had a lot of people successfully use this process and not get confused by it, so I think it's working. The great thing about ATP membership gift, you can get it literally Christmas morning. You know, there's no shipping. It's you just do a payment, and then you get a URL, and then you can either hastily print that or just write down the code that we give you, like the redemption code, and just stick it in a little envelope and put a bow on it. Perfect last-minute gift, no lead time required. Instantly delivered to you, atp.fm/gift.
Now, John, you've made me scared now because you've talked about how you have to enter the recipient's email address. You just said instantly delivered. Does that mean the gift will be given away immediately upon purchase?
No, we put in big red bold text, on the page after you purchase, here's the thing you have to give them. You have to give it to them. We won't email them. We won't send them anything. We won't spoil the surprise. After you make the purchase, you will have instructions on what you give to them. You could print that page. You could write it on a little piece of paper. You could put it in a little festive box. You could text it to them. You could do literally anything you want with it. You are the delivery person of the address, of the item.
What is that?
Do not disturb. I did not turn on do not
disturb. Is that a phone call? What is a phone call?
That is a FaceTime call from my daughter, who, despite living with me for her entire life, doesn't know when I podcast.
Do you need to answer that? Is that important?
No, someone else will answer it for me. Because it was a good FaceTime call, I think. I will just confirm.
Do we need to give you a different ending, Marco, or are we good?
Just have John repeat that little sentence where that began.
I don't remember what I was saying. What was I saying?
I don't remember either. I was so distracted by the by the noise.
You were saying put it in a box. I think Marco has a clean edit, but if you want to
review,
there's
some
place
you can end it in there or whatever. They deliver the thing. It'll be fine.
That's it. That's how you're going to make me end this?
No, that's not. That's not you. I think there were, like Casey said, I think there was already an edit point in there.
There is not.
Well, you're going to have to reboot the whole damn thing then.
Or I can just leave all this in.
You can just cut off that the whole part about it getting delivered, and then we can talk about it next week, because I do want to talk about it.
No. We need to have that part about it being delivered. That's important. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to do it again.
Just give me the end.
He left off.
Yeah, I don't remember what the end was. None of us remember what the end was. Holy God. All right. I'm going to give it to you again, and you don't have to make it as long, even though it was very well done. All right, here we go. All right, but John, you just mentioned that, you know, you need to enter the email of the person that's receiving the gift membership. You said something about delivering things immediately. Does that mean that if I buy a gift membership for you for Christmas, I'm going to spoil my Christmas gift to you?
No, we don't do any delivery for you. After you purchase a gift membership, you'll have instructions on what to do, and then you deliver the gift however you want to. You can print it out on a piece of paper. You can put it in a gift box. You can text it to them. You could mail it to them in the mail. You could do whatever you want with it. You could just read it to them on Christmas morning. It's entirely up to you. The surprise will not be spoiled by anything in our system, but that means that you must actually deliver the gift. And it is a last-minute gift idea. You do have to hastily write down the redemption code or print something out or text them. But, whether it's a piece of paper or a texted link, it works just the same.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad that the surprise will not be ruined. And again, atp.fm/gift. And this is doubly pertinent because we also need to announce that we have a new member special for December. We did ATP Movie Club, and we watched the 1983 film War Games with Matthew Broderick and Ali Sheedy and a bunch of other people. And I had seen it, but not in like 20 years. Marco effectively hadn't seen it. And John, you seem to know this movie inside and out. So anything you would like to add about that?
Yeah, I have some very, rapid fire follow up for the episode that I will try not to spoil. First, this movie has been often requested, and if you want to, if you're dying to listen to it, now's your time. For anybody who listens to it, you can listen to how many times I say nuclear and how many times I say nuclear. So that's a fun game you can play. Rest assured, I do know the difference, but unfortunately I was born in the 70s and a child of the 80s, and the incorrect pronunciation is wedged in my head. So you'll hear
it's
as
like
the,
Mario.
That's just an accent. Yeah, you'll hear as the episode goes on, my discipline gets worse and worse. So that's fine. Two, NORAD is located in Colorado Springs, Colorado, not Wyoming. We regret the error. Casey tried to point that out. I think I missed it.
No. I also got it wrong because I saw Cheyenne or whatever it's pronounced.
Yeah, Cheyenne. On the
sign, and I thought that was Wyoming. It is not. It is in Colorado, as you said.
Three, the 80s nuclear war movie that I was trying to remember is not The Day After Tomorrow. That's a 2004 climate disaster movie directed by Roland Emmerich. It was The Day After. These things jumble in my head because I'm old. I regret the error. And finally, the thing that I will not spoil, but you'll have to listen to the episode to know what I'm talking about. But the thing on the episode, I asked if anyone is aware of this thing existing before the movie War Games came out. Let us know. And I am here to tell you that tons of people let us know. And rest assured, the thing that is in that movie that we discuss did indeed exist well before that movie and is a widespread phenomenon all over this country, potentially coming here from Europe. Anyway, that's our follow-up for the member special. Slightly mysterious, but it's War Games. You should watch the movie even if you're not a member.
All right, John, you have yet another Cloudflare update. Is there trouble in paradise?
No, I mean, last time I was saying that I had switched over to that and had it sitting in front of my website and doing caching and SSL termination, and that they had, we did some follow-up about this workers thing they have, or the serverless thing that can do stuff, and you can host stuff in R2 and all those stuff, and I said I would look into that. I did. So now my website is fully on Cloudflare. I am using Cloudflare workers to actually serve my site. No traffic goes to my crappy shared hosting thing anymore for that particular website. There's other websites that are still there. And it's working pretty well, except that I quickly learned that when you do worker, it kind of sits alongside as a peer to caching. So I can't put like Cloudflare caching in front of my worker, but there's a caching API in the worker. So I basically have to manually do like the stuff that a web browser would do. I have to manually set the headers and the expires headers for caching. I have to manually deal with like trailing slashes and crap. I have to manually do caching. It's still like maybe two pages of code now instead of one, but it's a little bit silly. It would be nice if you could just say, hey, Cloudflare, do your caching thing in front of my worker. But still, the worker would have to do the cache expires header, because the way I had caching configured was to honor the headers that were coming out. Anyway, it seems to be working fine. I had a couple of glitches where I didn't fully reproduce the behavior that I had in Apache, but I think I'm going to run it like this for a while. I still have my shared hosting site, and I still have the site there, so I guess I'll publish to both sites, deploy to both sites as I go, but it's working pretty well, so... I guess I'll give you an update if anything disastrous happens, but for now, it's going pretty well.
And you said hypercritical.co is pointing to this worker site, is that right?
That's right. If you hit that URL now, everything you see there, the files are all hosted on R2, because I have some that are bigger than 25 megs, and I didn't want to do that weird bifurcation. And yes, I could have like made a back-end site at Cloudflare and then had it fronted by Cloudflare, and it's just, I didn't feel like going to that. I just wanted uniformity. Everything's in R2. It's fed by a worker. The worker acts like the world's dumbest static content web server, and it accesses Cloudflare's caching front end as it goes. I think it's way faster than it was before, because I tried it. I tried it both ways, like using my crappy shared hosting as the origin server with caching in front of it versus doing it all in worker. It's much faster to do it all in worker, because my crappy shared hosting was really bad. Like anytime it actually had to go to the origin server, the requests went from tens of milliseconds to hundreds of milliseconds, and it was ridiculous. So. Not that it matters for a static website, but it's faster now too.
Good deal.
Oh, well, and I went over the worker. I didn't go over it. I got the warning email that says you're close to the daily limit for free worker requests. So now, of course, I'm paying for worker. It's $5 a month. Not a big deal.
I mean, that's what I'm paying Linode currently for their baby. What is it, Nanode or whatever? And that's a full-on computer asterisk.
Yeah, that would have been easier. It's just that I got sucked into this whole Cloudflare thing. Like, I kind of wish I had your setup, because then I could just run a web server and configure it instead of writing my own crappy web server in Node.js, but whatever.
No, I honestly think either approach is perfectly valid. All right, let's talk about Marco's former TV. Wayne Morgan writes, regarding Marco's LG C7 image problem, this was a known issue with the C7 and B7. They actually had a repair notice where, until a few years ago, they would fix it for free. I had the exact same issues as you between Minecraft and the hue burn-in in the center.
Is that what yours look like, this picture, Marco?
I never put up like a solid color to test it. It was so apparent, like the shift towards green. And what we've heard over and over again is basically that like the red subpixels would wear out in the middle faster than everywhere else, possibly because some theories are like that's where people's faces are. And yeah, it's skin tone. And I don't know if that's true or if it's like heat or both, but whatever it is, this was a very common problem as reported by the incredibly rigorous data of people telling us about it. It seems like a pretty common
yeah, if you
problem.
Had, when it first started to happen, it sounds like you could have got it repaired for free, but you let it fester, and now it's kind of like Apple's keyboard repair programs. They eventually end, and so it's too late for you anyway.
Yeah, and it's the kind of thing, well, that particular problem, like the Minecraft burn-in with the hearts on the bottom, that's been there for years. But the particular problem of the middle of it slowly turning green, that's only been happening for, at least in a noticeable way, for maybe a few months. I think even if I had done it immediately, it would have been too late.
You needed a new TV anyway, so all's well that ends well.
It's funny though, besides the TV getting 10 inches larger diagonally, nobody in the family seems to notice. It's like, okay, now it's a TV.
And notice the giant blob in the middle of the old TV?
Well, they notice. Look, as I'm sure, not only the two of you, but certainly many, if not most, of our listeners are aware of a phenomenon when you are kind of the the person in charge of the technology of the house, you only hear about things that don't work. You don't really, like, when things work, great. No one, I mean, this is true of, you know, most household duties that most people do. Like, when things are working great, no one says anything. They might notice, probably not. They certainly don't notice enough to say anything. It's only when things go wrong or need attention that you tend to hear about them. So the way I am thanked, as with, again, with any household duties that people do, the way I am thanked for my hard work in this area is an absence of complaints. And I accept that.
I wish my family was more impressed by my TV. It looks really good.
Yeah, I wish my family was more impressed by my amazing Wi-Fi setup. But yeah, it just doesn't happen.
All right, let's talk Apple executives. First of all, Jeff Williams retired like 2 weeks ago and is now sort of kind of unretiring. Not really. But apparently Jeff Williams has been nominated to join the Disney board. So reading from Jay Peters in The Verge, or at The Verge, wherever, something The Verge. Jeff Williams, who recently retired from Apple, will stand for election, quote, as a new independent director at the company's 2026 annual meeting of shareholders, quote, Disney says. The board will be expanded from 10 to 11 members. Additionally, with regard to Johnny Srouji and, oh, where would he go if he did leave? Joshua Price writes, after watching the Rivian event this week where they announced that they're building custom silicon for their vehicles, could that be a potential competitor for Johnny Srouji? That Johnny Srouji would have considered?
That seems like a big step down to me.
It does, but you never know. Also, a lot of people reached out to say NVIDIA is another option potentially.
That's maybe a lateral move, but I don't know. NVIDIA seems a lot more volatile and is a new member of biggest company in the world club, which Apple's been a member of for a while.
Yeah. All right. With regard to last week's overtime, we were talking about carbon credits and Apple 2030, where they said they would be carbon neutral. I'm sure there's asterisk, stagger, double decker, etc. Zach writes, I actually work in the carbon credit space. This is, again, ATP. What did I call this? Something corner, job corner. I don't know. We have people everywhere. I actually work in the carbon credit space. My job is essentially carbon accounting. So I know quite a bit about carbon credits. In order to sell carbon credits that a company like Apple would purchase, you need to go through a registry. The registry uses independent auditors to verify the credits. In order for your credits to be valid, there are several criteria that need to be met, which includes a minimum of 100 years of stability. Part of this means you cannot sell your carbon capture byproduct into certain markets where, for example, they would be exposed to high temperatures or very acidic conditions that would result in the release of the captured carbon dioxide. The whole process of producing carbon credits is honestly a huge hassle, but it has to be that way so people cannot easily cheat it.
Yeah, it's a complex industry. It's not entirely a scam, but it's difficult to do in a way that satisfies everybody.
All right, we got a lot of feedback with regard to your split iMessage situation. Given that you haven't put a lot of follow-up in here, I'm assuming that means you have no particularly satisfying answers?
Oh, I mean, lots of people had suggestions that involved, you know, like tear your world down and start it back up again, or like suggestions that would never work, like, you know, which involves going around to everybody's device that you communicate with and forcing their settings into a particular thing. I think I mentioned this when we talked about it, but like there is that setting of like, by default, what do you want to begin conversations from? And also, what do you want to be reachable at? And those settings are like, I don't know if they're per device or per OS, but definitely there's different settings on Mac OS and iOS and iPads, and like policing everyone, even just in your like immediate family, just trying to police them and all their devices to make sure all their settings are rigidly set like this so you never bifurcate things, on the theory that the bifurcation is solely based on the fact that somebody started a message thread and they auto-completed two Apple IDs and one phone number or whatever, you know, like that's just not tenable. Like whether or not that would work, that's ridiculous. And I think it's stupid because the whole point of the contacts is to say all of these things refer to this person. So just show it as this person. But yeah, no, there were no solutions that I was willing to try because a lot of them are like, delete every thread you have, sign out of all your devices, sign out of your Apple ID, start a new thread. It's like, nope, no thanks. So yeah, they continue to be bifurcated, but things could be worse.
They could. So Sir Shannon writes, I just checked my pinned three-person group chat messages on macOS. So far this month, there are 21 separate conversations for that single conversation, one pinned and 20 unpinned. Three of the unpinned threads have the correct custom image. The rest, including the pinned conversation, do not. It's fine on iOS, mostly.
What is 3 choose 3, if I'm saying that right? Remember permutations and combinations?
Yeah, isn't it 3 times 2 times 1?
And I feel like there should not be 21 separate different ways to combine three-person group chat, if my math is right. But either way, that's ridiculous. Something is barely broken. And what recourse does Sir Shannon have? I don't know. Just deal with it. Just I don't like it. Anyway, no, it's intractable. I still have separate conversations. The best we can do is just, we all try to contribute to the one that's the highest up in our message list, and that usually works.
Yikes. All right, with regard to AI-generated voice-matched dubbing, particularly with, like, Fitness Plus, for example, Fran Basora writes, I've been able to try the Spanish dubbing of Apple Fitness Plus. It doesn't feel completely off, but you can tell a bit that it's an AI-generated dub. It keeps the essence of the trainer's voices, though, which makes it feel a bit more familiar. Stefana Secundus writes, I listened to a German track, and it's better than expected. The voice somewhat matches the trainer and conveys some emotion, though it's more monotonous than the original. Some translations are awkward, and the lip sync doesn't match at all. Overall, it's on the level of a dubbed teleshopping show. Far better than YouTube auto-dubbing, but not immediately obvious as AI, and usable if you don't speak English. And speaking of YouTube, Ben Madison writes, on the topic of generated voices, a few months ago I tried to airplay an MKBHD video from my Mac to my Apple TV, and the audio switched to what appeared to be Vietnamese, in Marquez's voice, and Ben then took a recording of that and uploaded it to, of course, YouTube, and it is pretty funny to watch for a little bit.
Do you think that's like YouTube auto generating that, or is that?
Yes.
Yeah,
it's got.
They do voice matching automatically now, I guess.
Yep, I feel like there was news about this like 6 to 12 months ago, but I probably can't put my fingers on a link or anything.
Real time follow up. I messed up the math on the choose thing because it should be like it's three basically like how many one? Different combinations of two possible things, phone number and email address, can you have with three people? And so please, mathematicians, you can write in and tell us what the correct math on that would be. But I still think it's not 21.
Good talk. All right. With regard to pronouncing your name correctly, and this individual has a name that my feeble American brain cannot pronounce very easily. And in the midst of complaining justifiably about Siri not pronouncing their name correctly, now I get to butcher their name. So you know what? Actually, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to say Paul Z writes, I've been fighting with my iOS to say my last name correctly for years. Prior to hearing your... Now I got to pronounce it. Otherwise, this doesn't
is
land.
It?
All right. Paul Zadanajski writes, I've been fighting with
I'm
iOS...
I'm guessing the J is silent.
Paul Zadanowski writes, I've been fighting with iOS to say my last name correctly for years. Prior to hearing a recent episode, it would pronounce my family members' names correctly, but butcher mine. As of today, and trying again with my contact card, as you just suggested, it will pronounce my name correctly when I ask what my name is. But when I say, hey, dingus, remind me to do X when I get home, it still pronounces my name wrong in the confirmation response, although less wrong than in previous years.
Now,
say
let me
it with
ask
me,
you,
everybody.
Why?
Shotguns are inconsistent.
Why is Siri acknowledging you back after a simple command with your last name?
Yeah, that I'm confused too. Unless Paul
is it like you know Mr. Zadanowski or something? Like is it like? But I've never. I don't know if there's a setting to have it address you that way. Mine doesn't address me at all by name.
Yeah,
mine
just says, okay. Remind you of that when you get home, or it repeats what your reminder is. I don't know. I mean, maybe the name is in the reminder text.
You know, like if I don't know someone's name, I'll try to avoid needing to say it. Do you think Siri just doesn't know any of our names except Paul? But everyone else, Siri's like, I secretly don't know this girl's name. So
Paul is her favorite. Maybe that's it.
it's the complaint we all have about Siri. It's like, in addition to it not working and being bad and broken, it's not even consistently bad and broken and not working. Sometimes things work, sometimes don't. Things that used to work stop working. Other things start working. It's just, it's ridiculous. And my shotgun thing was, in fact, the Destiny reference that five people will get. But
awesome.
It is what it is.
Good talk. All right. This is the time of the show when I do a little bit of reading for everyone's enjoyment. Joe Lyon has come back with some information about Intel learning from the chips at Fabs for Others. So Joe writes, a chip foundry doesn't get the design or schematic from the customer. The foundry just receives the final reticles or masks, masks, which is the design as implemented in physical layout over dozens or hundreds of masking layers. Depending on the relationship, the foundry doesn't necessarily know what the heck they're making, certainly not down to the circuit level. The foundry supplies a PDK, or a process development kit, to the customer that tells them what kind of transistors and other structures they can make, including the sizing and performance, and the PDK translates the customer's design into the final reticle set that is compatible with the foundry's process flow, all at the customer side. The reticle set is basically like a software binary, whereas the original schematic, or more likely the original VHDL code, is like the source code. Yes, theoretically, a binary can be decompiled or reverse engineered, but even after that, it's never the same as having the original source code. No comments, no documentation, variable names are arbitrary, etc. Same is true when trying to go from reticle backwards to schematic, much less the original VHDL code. And that is before all the policies that put into place to separate Intel Foundry from Intel product divisions. I'm assuming that Intel will put up an extremely strong firewall between those divisions because the Foundry model requires complete trust on both sides. It would immediately destroy the whole Foundry business if Intel started acting sneaky. Additionally, Jason Biotech writes, regarding the Apple giving their chip designs to Intel, my company has done some research on this problem. It seems intractable, as of course. You can't keep your design secret from the people you're asking to build the chips, right? The basic idea lies in sending a design that is obfuscated and non-functional when built, useless to everyone, including the chip fab, but that you, with secret knowledge only you possess, can fix afterward to produce the functional chip. Like any cryptography problem, because that's basically what this is, just in hardware, the devil's in the details. You can find more information on the company blog, which we'll link in the show notes.
Yeah, exciting title for the paper. Reverse engineer this towards provable cryptographic protection for circuit IP. I don't think Apple will be pursuing this, and I'm assuming Intel will be able to keep their secrets safe. But although it may be a small risk, it is non-zero, and also the risk of TSMC someday making their own chip designs is also non-zero. So it's not a perfect world, but we'll see. I'm still crossing my fingers that something actually happens with all this Intel stuff, but these are just rumors for now.
All right, and then finally tonight, James Wilby writes, I tried Apple's Migrate Purchases feature that was released earlier this year. Spoiler alert, it didn't work. I tried to do the sensible thing of waiting some time for any issues to be resolved and decided after the support articles were last updated in July that now could be a good time to try. I initially wasn't even able to see the option under my purchases account page, but after removing some test flight apps, the option appeared. But that should have been a sign right there, James. I'm sorry.
There was when we talked about this, like, oh, you can't do it if you have test flight apps. It's like, oh, I'll just remove the test flight apps. I'm sure it'll be fine.
Anyway, upon tapping a brief loading page, I received the warning, unable to migrate purchases. One or both accounts is not eligible for purchase migration. Many hours later, contacting Apple support, a long phone call in which I was told to delete any and all of my music library, even on my secondary account with the purchases, I was simply told, okay, so you just aren't eligible. Have a great day. Eligible, excuse me. Have a great day. I've asked for an escalation, but as of now, I'm no closer to migration and without any music library. I did my best to back it all up so one day I could rebuild. Thought I'd let you know this whole process is still half-baked with no explanation from Apple support, and we're going to hear more about that in just a second. Any other thoughts on this, though?
Yeah, when we talked about this, I think we all expressed skepticism and were kind of aghast at the limitations. I think one of which was, like, you can't have a music library, so now they're telling this person to delete their music library. This is definitely one of those things that we've asked for, you know, decades at this point. Like, oh, we should be able to merge Apple IDs or transfer purchases and stuff. And it's like, okay, fine. Apple, after a decade, we roll out this thing. And we're like, yeah, but does it work? And, like, for some people it works. But it's one of those features. When Apple announces something like this, you're like, I would do this if it was my last resort. Because I have no faith that it's going to work. If it does, hey, great. But if it doesn't, you're just in the situation where there's no good way out. Like, especially when you've done stuff like deleting your entire music library to try to make it work, and that also doesn't work, and then Apple support throws up their hands and says, "Eh, sorry, just sometimes things we make don't work for some people, and you're one of those people." So, yeah.
All right. So sort of, kind of speaking of, we have a news report. Well, not even news. It's a thing that's been going around.
It's a blog post.
It starts with a blog post. And this is Paris Butfield Addison, who writes, after nearly 30 years as a loyal customer authoring technical books on Apple's own programming languages and spending tens upon tens of thousands of dollars on devices, apps, conferences, and services, I have been locked out of my personal and professional digital life with no explanation and no recourse. The only recent activity on my account was a recent attempt to redeem a $500 Apple gift card to pay for my 6 TB iCloud Plus storage plan. The code failed.
Wow.
The vendor suggested that the card member was, card number was likely compromised and agreed to reissue it. Shortly after, my account was locked. An Apple support representative suggested that this was the cause of the issue, indicating that something was likely untoward about this card. The card was purchased from a major brick-and-mortar retailer, so if I cannot rely on the provenance of that and have no recourse, what am I meant to do? We have even sent the receipt, including the card serial number and purchase location, to Apple. The consequence is that my account is flagged as closed in accordance with Apple Media Services terms and conditions. I contacted Apple support immediately. The experience was terrifyingly dismissive. Support staff refused to tell me why the account was banned or provide specific details on the decision. When I begged for an escalation to Executive Customer Relations, or ECR, noting that I would lose the ability to do my job and that my devices were useless, I was told that, quote, an additional escalation won't lead to a different outcome. That is the support way of saying a polite, hey, fuck you.
Beep. Like, what is the point of escalation? If the people you ask to escalate can say, no, they won't say anything different than we do. Like, that means escalation doesn't exist.
Right, exactly. Many of the reps I've spoken to have suggested strange things. One of the strangest was telling me that I could physically go to Apple's Australian HQ at level 3, 20 Martin Place, Sydney, and plead my case. This just makes me think, what is it, like 42 Wallaby Lane from Finding Nemo? Anyway, they put me on hold for 5 minutes while they looked up the address. All right. So most insultingly, the official advice from the senior advisor was to create a new Apple account and update payment information. This is why this advice is technically and legally disastrous, in my opinion. And there's a bunch of reasons for that. But updates.
Well, we should touch on the reasons, though, because like they're basically saying, oh, just make a new Apple ID, essentially. But so many things in Apple systems say, hey, if we ban you and you just go make another Apple ID, that's a violation of our terms. If you have a bunch of apps, like if you're a developer and we ban your developer account and you just go make another Apple ID and republish your apps, that's a violation of our, like, following this advice from Apple would itself be violations that would cause his Apple ID to get banned. So it's ridiculous. And Yes, I know we keep calling it Apple ID, even though they renamed it Apple account. We'll see how long it takes at least me to pick up that vocabulary.
All right. So there's been some updates since this was originally written on the 13th of December. Then this is Australia, right? So this is effective. So Paris is 13th of December is really my 12th of December, generally speaking. But anyways, on Paris's December 14, someone from executive relations at Apple says they're looking into it. I hope this is true. They say they'll call me back tomorrow on the 15th of December. Then later that same day, the 14th of December for Paris, no luck so far, not looking good. Anyone got a good lawyer to send them a letter and or help me sue them? Here's my email address, says Paris. December 16, which is the 15th for us, no luck yet. December 18, as I sit here on the 17th recording, so it's the future. Paris writes, we're back. A lovely man from Singapore working for Apple Executive Relations who has been calling me every so often for a couple of days has let me know it's all fixed. It looks like the gift card I tried to redeem, which did not work for me and did not credit my account, was already redeemed in some way. It sounds like classic gift card tampering. And my account was caught by that. Obviously, it's unacceptable that this can happen, and I'm still trying to get more information out of him. But at least things are now mostly working. Strangely, he did tell me to only ever buy gift cards from Apple themselves. I asked if that means Apple supply chain, a Blackhawk network, Incom, and other gift card vendors is insecure, and he was unwilling to comment. I'll post a more substantive update soon.
So I'm glad this story got resolved before we talked about it, because it started in between our recordings, and I was hoping by the time we record, hopefully this will all become... I was surprised at how long it took, because once I saw like executive relations in the mix, I'm like, oh, this will probably be resolved. But it still took another, 4 days for it to get resolved? But yeah, this has been going around on all the various, blogs and websites and podcasts talking about it, and not because of the specific thing. I don't know this person, and it's not like we have a personal relationship with them, but I wish I had grabbed these stats. I thought I saw it fly by of like how many Apple IDs Apple bans per year. It's some astronomical number. Like, because there's just so much fraud and stuff like that. And like, to be clear, just like driving your computer to Craig Federighi's house, this is not a scalable system.
No.
For support, which is make a blog post, get everyone in the Mac enthusiast, tech sphere to notice it and constantly talk about it. And then maybe in a week, someone from Apple will wake up and say, what is this I'm hearing about something? What about like the thousands of other people who are in the exact same situation and don't have the ability to essentially mobilize the Apple tech nerd press to make stuff like this happen. But I think this is a good opportunity to just talk about this as a more general issue. I'm glad this person's specific issue was resolved, although it is terrible that it happened in the first place. But every time something like this happens, it just kind of reminds us all like how vulnerable we are to these companies. And you get all sorts of different people making suggestions about what could be done. Like the most common one I see is people say, it shouldn't be legal for companies to take away all your stuff like this with no recourse. Like, at the very least, people have this innate sense of justice, which is like, I know Apple's not the government, but doesn't it seem bad or unfair that they can take away all your stuff and not tell you why? Right? Because if they told you why, you could have a chance to defend yourself. They could say, we think you're, trafficking stolen iPods. And you're like, but I'm not trafficking stolen. Like, what is the accusation? What is the burden of proof? Whatever. And the fact is, it's the company and they can do whatever they want and whatever terms you agreed to basically say, we can do whatever we want, whenever we want. You have no, we get it. But because our digital lives, as we call them here, like the apps you make for a platform, all your family photos, all your email, like whatever digital stuff we have tied up into your Google account or your Apple ID or whatever, it feels like that stuff is so important to us that it shouldn't be able to get taken away with a snap of the fingers. But then people say, well, what do you want to happen here? Like, they're just a private company and you agreed to their terms, and so what's the solution? And that's why people start demanding, like, but there should be a law, like, for this specific case. And I think people reaching for there should be a law or companies shouldn't be allowed to do this is just one of the many, many signs of the same topic we talk about all the time, of insufficient competition, too much power in too few players. Because in an ideal system, in a market economy, quote unquote, like the fantasy version of this is that if you do things that consumers don't like, they will take their business elsewhere until you amass enough power to lock them in to the point where almost nothing you can do is bad enough to make them go elsewhere, because A, there's nowhere else for their go, or B, going elsewhere is so incredibly painful that no one will ever do it. And that is at the heart of all of these things. Like, why can companies get away with being bad to us? Why do we feel like we have no recourse other than to fashion these bespoke laws that only apply to three companies to, like, fix these problems piecemeal, right? It's because there's not enough competition in this market. They essentially have us locked in. And if they want to enjoy that privileged position, there should be additional responsibilities to go with it. In this particular country, we have the complete inability to pass any useful laws, including privacy laws. I think someone said, like, the last privacy law we passed was maybe HIPAA in the 80s or 90s. I might have the timelines wrong, but we're not able to pass any meaningful legislation. Europe is passing privacy laws and rearranging them or whatever, but it's just, like, the root of the problem is there are too few companies with too much power over us, and they are unconstrained, mostly unconstrained by any, you know, sense of decency or, like, you know, like, it's impossible to be it's impossible to behave perfectly. It's impossible for a company to not make mistakes banning accounts, right? And very often these stories come out and it's like you find out actually the person was running an illegal iPod stealing ring, right? But, like, the reason we say Kafkaesque is it should never feel like you're in, like, you know, a maze of twisty passages with no way out, and, like, you can't get in touch with a human and no one will talk to you. And anyone you talk to said, we can't tell you why we did it. We're not going to change our mind, right? I mean, think until this was fixed, this person was like, so you took away all my stuff. You won't tell me why, and there's nothing I can do about it. And they say, that's correct, sir. Like, that's terrible. And I don't think the solution is making individual laws about your digital identity and digital photos that apply to Apple and Google, right? It's rather, we should have systems where it's either not possible to get this big and have this much power, or there are constraints on companies that get this big and have this much power that apply to all such companies, not just, like, the two that store our photos.
Yeah, this is a really scary story, because it shows, like, you know, back in the earlier days of consumer computing, things were a lot less controlled by online accounts from one or two or three companies. Like, it was hard for you to lose all your data by the decision of, like, one computer company in the 90s or in the early 2000s. Right, because it was all, like, on your hard drive. Like, yeah, like,
you could screw it up yourself.
Yeah,
but you had yourself to blame.
You could lose all your data.
Better, I guess.
Yeah, you can lose all your data by not having a backup. And, you know, as we've gone more and more into, you know, cloud-hosted stuff, servers, sync platforms, into the mobile world where everything has to be, like, synced through services and stuff.
And not just online, but the fact that it's all encryption encumbered and in our country protected by the DMCA, so that, like, when you get locked out of it, it's a felony to try to get it back yourself.
Right, which, I mean, it wouldn't stop anybody in this case. They would use whatever tools they had at their disposal. But the problem is, like, once things are backed by services, there's really nothing more you can do about it. Like, you can't go in and hack Apple's servers to get your stuff back, you know, or change your account status or whatever. And so as we've moved into this, the current world of all of our computing platforms being so service dependent, that exacerbates the problem John was saying about there being so few companies that are involved here. Because not only are there very few companies that have us, you know, under such extreme control, but so much of our computing life is under their control that it isn't like if Apple blocks my account for some reason, not only do I lose access to a lot of data that, you know, that anything that's not backed up locally, which this is one of the reasons why I run my own backup service and have my own offline backups and stuff like that. Like, this is one reason why, because at least, like, you know, I wouldn't, like, lose photos or anything. But if my Apple ID gets locked, I could lose access to, like, businesses. I could, like, you know, depending on which, like, does my Overcast ID get locked? Then I could lose access to my entire business. And what am I supposed to do then? Upload a new copy to the App Store under a new developer
account?
That's
a violation of terms of service, because if they locked your Overcast account, you're not allowed to bypass it by saying, great, I'll just make a new Apple ID and put Overcast there.
And even if support told me, yeah, go ahead, you're allowed to do it, first of all, I would never trust that. But second of all, I would lose all my customers, all my subscriptions. I would lose it all. So, you know, that's not a solution. And so what has to happen here is these companies, I see the challenge here, because there obviously needs to be more ways for you to appeal these decisions and for humans to override them. You shouldn't have to, like, email the executives and have somebody and hope that somebody takes pity on you and gives it to their executive relations team to solve your problem.
Well, I mean, I feel like that would be more of a targeted solution to this, but the real solution is, like, I mean, to give a tiny, tiny example from the bad old days when you couldn't have a portable cell phone number, and then they passed a law that said, no, the phone companies have to let you take your number from AT&T to Verizon, right?
I mean,
that was one of the tiniest things they could possibly do, but before that, boy, was it like a big decision to go from AT&T to Verizon, because you got to tell everybody your new number. Those type of laws, like saying, even if you ban someone's, like, a HIPAA type law of, like, basically saying to Apple or Google or whatever, this data doesn't belong to you. So, yeah, you can ban their account, but you have to, by law, give them access to all of their stuff. And on that front, by the way, you're like, oh, I wouldn't lose my photos or anything. I back up all my photos, too, in many different ways. But if they locked my Apple ID, or actually it would be my wife's Apple ID because she's got the real account, although who knows, God knows how it works with shared libraries. But anyway, if they locked my Apple ID, I'm not sure I could launch the Photos app. And my photos are not just a bunch of raw JPEGs sitting in the file system. I have edits to them, and those edits exist as, like, entries in SQLite databases, like they're procedural, they're non-destructive edits. And those non-destructive edits only manifest by me launching the Photos app and it displays my photos. Would that app even launch or run if my Apple ID was banned? Because, again, iCloud Photos is turned on. Would I even be able to get to the settings screen to turn iCloud Photos off? Like, I'm not sure. Like, do these things work offline, right? So much stuff is tied in, cryptographically tied in to our Apple IDs that if they're locked, I mean, I'm pretty sure I could still log into my accounts on my Mac because I'm not using Apple ID login there, although I think that's one of the options. But I have no confidence that, like, literally any Apple app that contains my data would launch, even though the data would be on my thing. Like, I unplug all my internet from my house. Like, there's no kill switch coming in. There's no find my wipe coming in. How many apps would launch and display data? Would the Notes app work? it's terrifying because this is a thing that is never tested. And by law, Apple doesn't have to do anything. They can just say, bye, all your stuff is gone. You have no recourse.
Yeah. So two things. Number one, I see also, like, so my position is that there needs to be, like, a human appeals and override process. It can't just be like, sorry, support said no, there's nothing we can do. Sorry, it's final. That's it. Like, there needs to be...
Your only chance is to run to the press, which never helps, but it's the only thing that works.
Yeah, there needs to be a human escalation process at all these companies. I also understand that at the scale they're operating at, the amount of scams that are trying to be done against them constantly is so incredibly high. Like, you know, we've talked before about, like, you know, hearing bits and pieces about things like, you know, the Chinese parts scams against iPhones, and, like, there's so much. So many attempts.
I have a number of how many accounts they ban. Like, it was like millions of accounts, because there's so much scamming that there has to be an automated system to knock them down.
Right. And so I understand why they might feel that it's impossible to offer any kind of appeal at some level because it would just be overwhelmed. But that's their responsibility by being in this position in the first place. There
and
needs
that's why you
to
have to
be
mandate
a
it by law, because then all their competitors would have to do it too. And so they can't say, well, if we did this but our competitors didn't, now we're spending millions of dollars a year that our competitors aren't spending. Never mind that there's barely any competitors. But yeah, mandate it by law.
Yeah, and it's, I think it's one of those things, you know, Apple, as we've talked about before, Apple is very cheap with labor, both in terms of you know, maybe not necessarily paying super competitive salaries, you know, when you know, Meta's paying big bucks in certain areas. But also, Apple historically understaffs a lot of departments by just numbers. Like, you, like whatever you think the number of people working on something at Apple is, it's probably a lot less than that because they just don't like doing that. And in many ways, that helps. You know, the more people you have, you get a lot more bloat, you get a lot more management requirements and challenges. And it's and obviously, you know, there's limitations in a lot of ways and trade-offs in a lot of ways. But the reality is Apple teams can often be way smaller than they need to be for their current scale. We see that in developer relations. We've seen it in things like documentation. You know, you see a lot of issues with, like, a lot of Apple teams seem like they're pretty understaffed. So that that also could be a role here that, like, maybe for Apple to offer a real human escalation process here, they just don't want to hire that many people. To me, again, my response, if that would be their answer, would basically be that's too bad. Like, you have this responsibility. Now, I don't think, first of all, there's two things. I don't think the other tech companies are particularly better at this than Apple is.
No. This is, Apple just happens to be today's example, but it could just as easily be your Google account.
Yeah, like we've heard stories about Google doing similar things too with your entire Google account. Like that happens with all the big tech companies. Amazon, you know, it happens to them all.
Because they all have the same problem, as you pointed out. They all have millions and millions of customers. They're not going to pay enough human beings to service the in-person, human-to-human requests of millions of people running to this, most of which are at legitimate, you know, illegitimate fraud or whatever, to find the one human who was wrongly accused. They just have automated systems because it's cheaper and because nothing is telling them that they can't do that. And why would they spend millions of dollars that their supposed competitors don't have to spend? Or why would they just spend it because they're cheap? Like, you mentioned that it's their responsibility, but, like, responsibility is not a thing that most corporations feel in any real capacity. The only thing that keeps corporations behaving well is the fear that if they treat their customers badly, their customers will take their business elsewhere. And that fear is eliminated by getting big enough and powerful enough. You can essentially eliminate the fear that if we do something that annoys our customers, they will go elsewhere. I mean, it's the same thing we always say about airlines. They're like, oh, if you say you're never going to fly airline X again, you run out of airlines real fast, because there's not a lot of airlines. Too right. much power in the hands of too few companies makes it so the feedback mechanism of market capitalism stops working, and the companies can do whatever they want that annoys whoever they want, because what are you going to do about it?
The other thing, though, is that when we're trying to think of, like, you know, what should help or what could help or what should be done here, I don't think using, like, cell phone number portability as an example is a very relevant example at this level, because the reason why cell phone number portability works is because different cell carriers are all providing the same service. It's fairly low down the stack in terms of what they're providing, and they're communicating over standard protocols, you know, between themselves, like between the phone network to reach other phone numbers and route calls.
And yet they didn't want to do it.
Well, of course.
I just thought it was a tiny example. It's not like it's suddenly, and now cell phones are fixed because we still have, like, three choices and they all suck, right? Like, the cell phone companies are in the exact same situation, too much power and too few hands, and it also has the whole infrastructure problem of cell towers and yada, yada, yada. I'm just saying, like, an example of how companies will not do even the smallest thing unless you force them to do it by law, and how things were actually worse before that tiny little law passed that allowed in this country you to take your cell phone to a different carrier. That's all I'm saying. I mean, you're right. Okay, you're right that, like, because they're, like, essentially a commodity, that it's, but, like, I'm saying that type of thing, no matter how common sense it is, will not happen unless you can somehow pass a law. And we seem in this country less and less able to pass any kind of useful law. And even that was, like, pulling teeth.
Yeah. But, yeah. And so, like, in general, I don't think the solution is you should give people a way to export their data. You should. That's a separate thing, though. That's not going to solve this problem. That's, you know, that can help other things. That can help things like, you know, transferring accounts between countries. That's still messed up. That can help just basic backup needs, data export needs, you know, privacy export needs.
Well, I mean, it's not
needs.
Just export. But do something like a topic that we'll get into in overtime, cable card, where it's like a standard that everyone has to support for both export and import. So now your digital life is by law portable from one place to the other, and then watch how everyone maliciously complies with that law. But anyway, yeah.
Though, I think that's a pipe dream. I think the idea, you know, people have often said, you know, social networks should be required similar to, you know, the number portability. Like, social networks should be required to let you take your network out to a different platform. That's never going to really happen because the platforms are different. And this is the problem with anything that's like, let me take my stuff out and go somewhere else. Go where? To another clone of the Apple ID system? There, like, no such thing exists. And even if you think, like, okay, what if I export, say, you know, from Twitter to Threads, or, you know, so if you take, like, two similar seeming things, even that, the platforms are so different that what that would actually look like would be really weird and limited and not what you think and hope it would be. And there, of course, everything would be challenged legally like crazy, because it's like, you know, then you're saying, like, does Facebook need to let you, like, access their network for free? Like, so there's all sorts of practical and legal and just technical issues with that.
I don't think social networks would be the thing that people care about. It's more like, you know, my family photos, you know, my email, stuff like that. And again, it would only be in cases where they've banned your account and otherwise you would have no access to your stuff. Google, by the way, Google Takeout is a pretty good system. They did this essentially on their own. I believe there is no law forcing them to do this, but Google allows you to export all your data. So does Apple. Apple has their export format's not as good, but all these companies have some way for you to get your data out. But those only work if your account is not locked. The time when the time when you really need them to work is when they've locked you out of your account and won't tell you why. That's when you need your photos, right? Or again, a guaranteed way to run the Photos app offline without logging in and be able to see all your photos and your edits. Like, I mean, this is not a thing. Like, trying to make a law to say you should be nicer with people's data is like, it's not getting at the root of the problem here, which is that this market is not competitive. How can they get away with being this bad to their customers? The only answer is the customers have nowhere else to go. They can do almost anything to customers. They release buggy stuff, charge what they want, you know, screw them over. And like, no matter how many horror stories you hear, like, there's nowhere to go. There's nowhere else to run. It is a malfunctioning market. The feedback mechanism is not working. And that feedback mechanism is essential. Like, it's much better than laws. Like, we do laws when, like, oh, you get so big, we now need laws constraining you because you're too big, and people get all upset about that and have all these theoretical arguments or whatever. You don't need those laws when it's a bunch of smaller companies fighting tooth and nail for each other's business, because they're intrinsically motivated, or I guess extrinsically motivated, to do better than their competitors, to get customers to come to them and not that. But then eventually you get the winners, and the winners crush everybody else, and now there's two or three companies left, and they don't have to do that anymore. They just do whatever they want, and they all kind of agree to kind of do the same things, and like the market disappears, and it just becomes, now we are government size entities being regulated by the actual government in this weird, you know, dance of billionaires while everyone else gets screwed.
Yeah,
cool.
And because, like, see, I don't think anything is going to help in terms of, like, you know, just take this and go somewhere else, start a new account, go and move to Android. Like, none of those solutions help, because
after Android ban you, where do you go?
Right, because it's too these companies are too big and too sprawling, and there's too few of them. It's like imagine if you live in a medium-sized city and you have, like, you know, maybe one or two good airlines that serve your airport. And suppose one of them bans you.
Imagine that.
Right. Like, suppose you're served by, like, you know, Delta and United, and Delta bans you. Can you just not fly to most cities anymore?
Well, like, if you try to fly United, that's correct, because it never works.
Well, that's true. But so, like, that's the level, you know, what if your ISP bans you? In America, most people have one or two broadband ISPs to choose from. If your ISP bans you, what are you going to do? Maybe if you have a second one, and you know, the second one would be a different type, it would probably be significantly worse for you, because it would be like, you know, you might have to go back to, like, you know, go back to some kind of oversaturated cable node instead of a fiber node, or
oh,
whatever.
God, trigger warning.
Yeah, so like, so there's all sort, like, there's lots of industries where you only have one. What if your electric company bans you? Like, yeah, those what are you going to do about this?
Well, the ISP one is a good example, because lots of towns and cities are trying to do municipal broadband, which is broadband owned by the city, not owned by Comcast or Verizon or whatever. And every single city that does that, everybody loves it. It's cheaper. It's better. It's faster. You know who doesn't love that? Comcast and Verizon. Yeah. They don't love it. They lobby against it. They pass laws disallowing towns and cities from doing that. They say it's against the law for you to implement municipal broadband. No, you have to, by law, pay for the two choices that you have here. And they, because they know if there was competition, people would never choose Comcast. Like, who would, right? It's just like people would not choose it because the competitors have better service at a lower price. And that's how capitalism is supposed to work. But when you get big enough and there's few enough of you, you can make sure that doesn't happen. But we've seen the success story. You can just see the people in like the, you know, the Comcast Xfinity Verizon boardroom saying, we've been seeing all these feel good human interest stories about this little town in Wyoming that implemented municipal broadband and everybody in the town has like 5 gig fiber symmetric and it cost them $5 a month. We hate that. Can we stop that somehow? We're like, with laws? And the answer is yes. Yes, they can, because they have money to lobby.
Yeah. But so all this is to say, like, the idea that we can just take our stuff and go elsewhere for companies of this scale, That's not a valid solution to a problem with your system having this limitation. The problem, it's like telling somebody like, oh yeah, like the United States has a lot of problems right now. Why don't you move to a different country? Like, well, for most people, that's literally not possible. And even for the ones who it is possible for, that's a pretty big lift to move your entire life to a different country. So the much better solution for these companies is to be forced to fix them from within. Like, just like it's like the best thing to do in the U.S. right now is try to fix it from within, because it's our country and it's where we all live, most of us. Sorry, everyone else. But, you know, it's like, so the way to fix this problem with Apple's account system is not to say, well, we'll give you the tools you need to move somewhere else. No. The problem is for Apple to provide human appeals processes that work and that are accessible. And if they have to hire more people to do it, that's their responsibility at the scale that they're at in the monopoly status that they pretty much have, or the duopoly status they have. So that's the solution. The solution is they have to fix it. And if it takes legislation in various forms to do that,
absolutely
so be it.
Legislation, because they've evidenced they won't do this themselves. They won't. They haven't, and they won't.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, mm-hmm. and I do think, even despite all of that, I still think that part of it should be a new privacy law in the U.S. that dictates what companies can and can't do with your data and what rights you have to your data, which would include the ability to export it even if they lock your account. Even though that doesn't solve the problem, I agree with you there, it still needs to be there as a backstop. Because what about when you go through the human review process that is mandated by law and is a kangaroo court and they just say no anyway, even though you get to do a human review? Still then you would say, okay, but this law says I still get my data.
It has to be greater than just data access. Because, what if you lose access to, like, all of the purchases you've ever made in your Apple account?
Oh, well, that's going to be a harder road to hoe. I didn't even mention purchases, because good luck getting that reversed, because we have tons of laws on the book that basically say, hey, you didn't buy those movies, you bought a limited license to those movies, and yada, yada. That we've already got laws surrounding that, and the laws are against us. So
that wouldn't just be putting in new laws.
That would be overturning existing laws.
So you have multiple issues. You have your own personal data. Okay. You also have whatever purchases you've made to content and services on that account.
Goodbye.
Then you also have the potential of, what if you have like an app in the App Store, or for Google accounts, what if you have a YouTube channel on that account?
Yeah, kiss those goodbye too.
Well, right, but those have, like, that's lawsuit territory. That, like, really.
Well, and, good and luck so with you, that lawsuit.
Right, and so again, like, so you have to, like, they can just snuff you out completely with some automated system for some, you know, theoretical violation that many people probably do, but you might not have done.
Yeah.
You know?
Those are tricky to deal with, though.
What do?
Give the YouTube example. Like there is no competitive online video service where you can go.
Right.
Like, if you're off of YouTube, you're up, right? And so, like...
Right. If you're out of the App Store, you have an iOS app, where the heck are you going to put it?
Right. Exactly. So it's exactly what all the countries are saying, which is like, okay, well, so that kind of shows that Apple or YouTube or whatever has gotten so big that they can't just be treated like a regular company. Because if you're talking about just a regular company that's, like, small, none of these things make any sense. Why would, you know, like, just, like, this is not a problem. Just go somewhere else. But, like, now you're so big that you are institutionally inescapable, and a whole new set of rules needs to apply to you, and everybody, all the billionaires hate that, and a lot of people think that's too much regulation or whatever, but it's like, the alternative is we are ruled by a tiny number of extremely powerful corporations, and we're in some dystopian sci-fi novel, and we're basically living that now, and most of them are somewhat benevolent, but see Twitter/X to see how that can go awry real fast. So, yeah, it's difficult because we haven't been in, I don't think the world has been in this position many times except for, like, you know, Standard Oil and the Railroad Trust or whatever. And those were broken up by laws, but it didn't take our country at least very long to say, you know what? We didn't need to do it. That's still, why did we ever do that? What was wrong with Standard Oil? It seemed fine. Anyway, as long as consumer prices don't go up, it'll be fine. and so we're kind of in the other, we've swung way in the other direction, and now every company can buy anybody that they want, whenever they want, and get gigantic. And again, that seems like it's fine, except we, like, it's difficult to come up with laws that constrain companies when they're that big. It's easier to not let them get that big, but not letting them get that big is also kind of like anti-market capitalism. Is like, well, if they get that way fair and square, which they never get that way fair and square, let's be honest. But if they did get that way fair and square, it shouldn't be legal to be incredibly successful. It should be legal to abuse that monopoly power and see all the court cases that have been winding through and are at various stages of falling apart. But yeah, like that's like these situations, Google account, Apple ID, whatever, always seem they're like it's big mean corporation, consumer, you know, what was that consumer protection agency that our country recently got rid of because it was costing big companies too much money. Like, big companies take advantage of people all the time, and there is a role in government to try to stop them from doing that, but things are going in the wrong direction. But yeah, this is not a, like, Apple should be nicer. Apple will never be nicer unless something makes them be nicer, and it's difficult to come up with a set of things that will make them be nicer, like, to do that well. I mean, see Europe. Europe's been trying with the DMA and the GDPR and stuff like, it's not easy to get right, but I'm pretty sure that doing nothing is not the right solution.
This reminds me, if you'll permit me, a very brief tangent where I will try not to be too whiny. a couple of days ago, well, let me back up just a teeny bit. We talked a few episodes ago about how Declan has been doing like a squint and it looks like HyperCard, choose your own adventure sort of kind of rage baity thing on Google Slides. And he's been very, very, very concerned that his school Google account will get cleared out in the summertime. I genuinely don't know if it will or not. I mean, my gut says it won't, but he's very concerned about this.
And rumor in the school says it will.
I mean, who knows? Yeah, exactly.
The school rumor mill is very trustworthy.
Right. The fifth graders know exactly what's going to happen. But anyways, and so he wants to make his own personal Google account, fair enough, where he can house some of these things. Again, totally fair. I go to make him a Google account so he can use Google Slides because that's what he's used to and familiar with. And, you know, yeah, he could use Keynote or something, but this is what he's used to. And I go to make him a Google account. Google says, yeah, that's well and good. Give us a birthday, which, you know, I'm like, I don't really love that. And I immediately fibbed, but that's neither here nor there. And then, okay, he'd give us what email address do you want? And I made up some email address that, you know, was, you know, some moniker or handle that he would want. Or I guess I should say I use the moniker that he made up. And the next step is, okay, scan this QR code so we can go ahead and get your phone number. I'm sorry, what? yeah, we need your phone number because you can't make a Google account without it. Oh, wonderful. That's so cool. And it just got me thinking about when we were kids. It got me thinking, too, about when Marco and I were kids and hanging out, you know, outside a very tiny lake in upstate New York. When none of this fucking bullshit ever happened. When you would just turn on the computer and do things. Like, it was so much nicer then. In a lot of ways, it was terrible. In a lot of ways, it was awful. But in certain ways, it was so much nicer and so much simpler there then, I should say. And I kind of miss that. That's not to say I prefer it. It's not to say I want to go back there. But it just kind of sucks that in order for Declan to use the software he wants to use, which only exists online, he needs to create a Google account, which he cannot do because he does not have a phone number. And yes, I could like make a burner number, but then what happens for account recovery? And I believe, if I recall correctly, I tried mine at one point and it was like, well, no, that's already used for a different account. You can't do that. Maybe the answer is to make him a child account, but then inevitably he'll be like neutered and gutted in some ways that's going to be inconvenient or whatever. I'm not really looking for a solution, but it's just, it made me think about how wonderful it was when the stressful thing about using a computer was how much conventional memory you had to play the game you wanted. So it was whether or not you loaded the mouse driver in your AutoExecBAT and config sys, was whether or not you had an IRQ conflict with your Sound Blaster. And
this
those
sounding great.
I know I was setting you up for this, John, and I knew you'd take the bait and I was right, but still, it's just, I in so many ways, that was so nice, especially as someone cutting your teeth trying to learn what technology was. And in a lot of ways, things today are so much better. Scratch is incredible. The internet is amazing. I wouldn't have a job, or at least this job, I should say, without the internet. And hell, the last several jobs I had, almost my entire career, the majority of my career has been something internet related. It's either been an iOS app that uses the internet or literally writing websites, you know, and working on websites. So I'm not saying necessarily that I want to go back in time, but it's like it's an offshoot of the same topic. Like these gigantic conglomerates control everything, and there's no recourse if you disagree with them. I don't want to give you a phone number. Well, you know what? Then get fucked. You don't get a new account. Like, it's just frustrating. And what does an individual do about that?
You just shout. Keep in mind, what you're doing is fighting to get your son into one of these giant silos where they'll have no recourse.
Exactly. Yo, you're right, which is
like,
a sick thing.
Like, because these big providers are so powerful and so important that it is actually important for us to get an online identity and have a place where we accumulate our digital lives and communicate with everybody and do all the things that you have to do. It's not possible to live in this world without in the modern world to try to get a job, to have, you know, some place of residence, some way to be reachable. And these days that means a phone number, which is probably a cell phone and probably an email address. And like, just good luck trying to live in the modern world without any of those things. And where do those things come from? A very small number of very big, very important companies. So it's not like you can say, sorry, Declan, you'll never have an online identity because we're never going to give you a phone number and you're never going to have an email address. And it's like, that's not a tenable way to live in the modern world. And you want your kid to have, you know, like, well, run your own web servers, run your own mail servers. Like, that's not tenable for us. People get accounts on whatever, you know, the AOL, Hotmail, a Gmail, a Microsoft account, an Apple ID. There's not too many of those things that are sort of reliable, long-term places to have your online identity. And so what you're trying to do is get him into the system that you know he needs to participate in. Not, you know, he just wants to mess with his, like, Google Sheets, but eventually these are systems that people need to participate in to live modern life, and there's too few people controlling those systems. So I feel for you, but it's like, you know, you're failing to get him into the system that we're complaining about, it because there's no other choice. It's the perfect example of there being no other choice.
Yep. I mean, I can't run Google Slides locally, I think. I mean, maybe I can.
There's an offline mode, but yeah. Someone's probably ported it to WebAssembly, and there's some web version of it somewhere.
Anyway, it's just frustrating. All right. Hello, Future Marco. Hi. We are running very long. I don't know if we have time for the Netflix thing. We can do it if you want, but I think
we can try to go through it quickly. We'd not do all this reading, but just give like the summary of it.
Oh, really, John? Perhaps not doing all the reading, you say?
Mm-hmm. Jesus. Or you could let me do it, and I'll try to do it quickly. But
no, I can do it quickly. This is what I asked to do, and then Daddy always says no. All right, here we go. All right, we have a little bit more news that we want to talk about before it gets stale. Netflix is allegedly, maybe, going to acquire Warner Brothers, which is a sentence I don't think I would have been able to understand 10 or 20 years ago. On December 5th, Netflix and Warner Brothers Discovery announced they have entered into a definitive agreement under which Netflix will acquire Warner Brothers, including its film and television studios, HBO Max and HBO. Blah, blah, blah. Basically, $83 billion is the total cost. Netflix is saying, oh, this is going to be great. It will offer more choice, more opportunities, and more value.
And by the way, the more choice thing, like, it's hilarious in light of our previous conversation about choice, because, like, how does giant companies combining to be even fewer giant companies produce more choice? But what they mean is, somewhat interestingly for this thing, is like, so you pay for Netflix, you'll have more stuff to watch, which is a early signal that they're saying, hey, we're buying them, they have a bunch of stuff, we're probably going to put most of that stuff in Netflix because we're Netflix and you pay for Netflix, and we'll see. Like, I mean, maybe there'll be like an HBO upsell or whatever, but it's interesting that in the merger agreement, they're like, yeah, this will give us more stuff to put in Netflix. Plus also maybe there's like, well, you'll pay extra for HBO inside Netflix. Who knows? Who knows? But anyway, that's a slight aside.
So anyways, Dominic Preston at The Verge writes, to get the deal over the line, Netflix reportedly pledged a $5 billion breakup fee in case regulators block the buyout. Netflix bid one out over interest from Comcast and Paramount, fresh from its own merger with Skydance, though early interest had been reported from Amazon and Apple too. And obviously, there's still a bunch of regulatory hurdles they'll get to have to get through. The Trump administration says it already views the deal with, quote, heavy skepticism.
Yeah, well, and that earlier thing of, like, in case regulators block the buyout, why would regulators block the buyout?
Yeah, it's funny.
Why would that happen?
Yeah, it's funny you ask that. So then Paramount apparently Hi, Future Marco. Hi. I was deliberately skipping that for brevity, but
yeah,
that's
fine.
Relevant
no, it's fine.
Now.
It's fine. You can skip it. You can skip it.
Okay, goodbye, Future Marco.
Bye.
So speaking of regulators, Paramount has launched a hostile $108 billion bids. That's, 25-ish billion roundabouts, more than the Netflix one, to snatch Warner Brothers from Netflix.
But not really more, because they want to buy more, so the per share price is actually lower, which makes this even more nonsensical. But anyway, just keep, like, they weren't, Netflix isn't going to buy, like, the TV stuff, but the Paramount bid is going to buy it. So even though the number looks bigger, per share it's lower.
So Paramount offered this, you know, $108 billion, blah, blah, blah. They're going to take the whole kit and caboodle, allegedly. But then things get interesting. So regulatory filings spotted by Axios, this is reading from The Verge, indicate that Affinity Partners, a private equity firm founded by President Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, is also part of Paramount's bid. Trump commented on Netflix's plan to acquire Warner Brothers on Sunday, saying the deal could be a problem and that he'll be involved in the decision to approve it. So, okay, so we know that Kushner's involved, which already gets me raising one humongous eyebrow. But who is kind of leading the charge? Well, it turns out, to read this incredible headline from an article by Elizabeth Lopato on The Verge, Larry Ellison of Oracle's big dumb of Oracle, excuse me, Larry Ellison's big dumb gift to his large adult son, which is incredible.
Yeah. David Ellison is the CEO of Paramount Skydance, another merger. That's why CBS was giving in to our criminal in chief's demands to do what he wanted. Otherwise, he would block the merger, and they wanted the overlords wanted the merger to go through. So they did what he said and allowed CBS to be taken over by, you know, people who aren't reporting. Anyways, it's our just, if you're wondering what's going on in the United States, have you ever seen an organized crime movie? That's how our country runs now. The president has things that he wants and has friends, and if you don't do what he wants, he will do everything in his power, many things that are not in his power, technically speaking, to punish you for it. And him and his son-in-law and his friend Larry Ellison all really want Paramount to buy Warner Brothers. But Netflix wants to buy them, and Warner wants to sell to Netflix. But, oh, your merger needs to be approved by the government, and the government now exists as the single person of Donald Trump, and he wants his friend's big, large adult son to have this company to play with so he can ban CNN and make sure people never say mean things about his dad. It's just, it's so sad. It would be comical if it wasn't so, like, real and sad. So I'm not sure how this is going to turn out. In any sane world, they would take they've agreed to sell to Netflix. Netflix is technically offering them a higher number per share. It's terrible that these things are merging, but Warner Brothers has been run by a person who has no idea what he's doing and has been screwing up that company, which is like, well, whatever. Like, again, I don't like to see big companies merge. Notice there's no talk of like, oh, well, we shouldn't allow this merger because it's bad for further consolidation in the entertainment industry. No, everyone's fine with that. It's just a question of who gets to control it all, because eventually, instead of having 17 billionaires, it'll just be three and they'll all be related.
Cool.
Awesome.
So then Gruber had a take on it, which we'll link in the show notes. And additionally, CNN's Brian Stelter reports that Netflix was prepared for this to happen. Today's move was entirely expected, Netflix co-CEO Ted Sarandos said on stage at a UBS conference just now, waving off Paramount's hostile play for Warner Brothers. What is the D in Warner Brothers?
Discovery.
Thank you, Discovery. We have a deal done, and we are incredibly happy with the deal. We're super confident we're going to get it across.
Yeah, Warner Brothers Discovery, like Warner Brothers, remember they were, wasn't it like a Time Warner and then AOL Time Warner and then Warner brought Discovery? Like, these are already giant conglomerations that have been passed around a million, but they're just condensing even farther. It's just hitting. Hideous, shambling monster filled with ancient and valuable IP and a bunch of executives who have no idea what they're doing and just looking out for themselves.
Yep. There's been a couple of, or maybe it was just one, but Jason and Mike on Upgrade had a really good conversation about this. I don't remember if it was a couple of days ago or last week. There's also, you know, a bunch of additional stuff that we'll put in the show notes. But my understanding is it's not great that, you know, Netflix is potentially going to be buying one of these big entertainment companies. There's a lot of consternation as to what is going to happen to the movie studio portion of Warner Brothers. You know, Netflix is currently saying, oh, it'll be its own thing. But let me tell you, having lived through a couple of mergers, and John, you've lived through more than me, I think, anytime somebody buys something else and says, oh, it's going to remain exactly as it is forever, that's a lie.
Yeah, that never happens.
And I don't think anyone wants to keep it exactly as it is now because nobody is happy with it. The only silver lining in this entire thing is that currently there is probably still more competition in the streaming video market than there is in, let's say, the cell phone operating system market, to give just one example. There's less competition all the time if we allow these mergers to go through, but Netflix thus far has mostly been motivated by trying to do things that make it appealing to customers. And that includes like making the ad supported tier, because a lot of people would rather just have ads and pay a lower price or whatever. But as they gobble up more and more companies, pretty soon they'll reach that size where it's like, well, we own so much media. Like when Netflix buys Disney, then we have real problems. Disney already owns like everything. And Warner Brothers has a bunch of really old stuff, and Netflix has got some stuff on its own. Like, we cannot have two entertainment companies for streaming video and movies in this. It's depressing, but you know what would be even more depressing is if David Ellison gets it, because at least the people running Netflix have some clue about how to be the entertainment industry, and their qualification is not, I'm the large adult son of a billionaire who's friends with the corrupt president.
Excuse me, I learned today as I was doing research for this, David Ellison was briefly an actor. He was even in a movie with James Franco.
I'm sure he got that acting job all on his own.
Yep, I'm sure he did.
Based on his talents as an actor. Like so many other children of Hollywood stars.
Right. Anyway, there's a lot of links in the show notes that John has been kind enough to assemble, and I put in the show notes for you. But it's just a mess. It's just a mess. And this is capitalism today. This is America today. It's icky.
Yeah, and this is the complete lack of any kind of regulation of companies merging with each other. Like Warner Brothers, Discovery, AOL, Time Warner, AT&T owner, like just so many, they combine, they're incompetently run, a disaster strikes, and then the people just want to get out and sell. Like, that's the whole reason, like, the CBS takeover by all these right-wing people. CBS used to be a television network for old people, let's be honest, but, like, still trying to be just a basic television network, and right-wing people like, well, what if we owned it and made them only say nice things about us? And so that's what they're doing. And how did they make that happen? The people who owned that whole big blob of stuff had mismanaged it, and they wanted to get out, and they wanted their money, and they're like, we want to have this merger happen. And the president said, well, we're not going to let your merger happen unless you do what we want. And they said, okay, fine, we'll do what you want. Why? Because the billionaires needed to get their money, because they would never be able to survive the rest of their life. They just don't have enough money. They're like, well, we need this merger to happen. Why do you need this merger to happen? Because we need the money. You don't need the money. But they basically sold out. Instead of fighting, they said, no, we'll do whatever you want. Just let this merger go through. Yay, the merger goes through. And then they installed Barry Weiss as the head of CBS News. So this is the world we live in. Again, if you don't know who these people are, for A, be glad. And B, if you want to learn, there will be links in the show notes.
It's just everything's garbage. Everything's garbage. And I guess that's how we're ending the show tonight. So.
Yeah, I mean, the main story in the show of like being locked out of your Apple account and not having access. Like, it's got a silver lining because it had, like, I guess, a happy ending. But like I said, this is one of those things where even where the ending is satisfying, oh, the person got their account back. You just, like, that doesn't make me feel any better.
No.
Like, this should never have happened or been possible. And no one listening to this is comforted by that, because they're like, well, at least you guys have a podcast where if one of you guys gets their account locked, you can complain about it. Maybe someone will hear you. What about me out here who doesn't know anybody and can't get John Gruber to post some daring fireball about my account being locked? I'm sure there's thousands of people who this happens who have no recourse. So that's why, even though it turned out well in this case, it almost makes me feel worse that it turned out well, because it shows that the only way to get any justice in this type of system is to somehow get enough notoriety and fame to raise the level where some executive notices that their company might be doing something wrong, and they do a pinpoint one person fix and they go back to sleep.
Yep. Everything's trash. So happy holidays, everyone.
Thanks to our sponsors this episode, Squarespace, Guru, and Notion. And thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atp.fm/join. One of the many perks of membership is ATP Overtime, our weekly bonus topic. Every podcast, you can get another usually 15, 20 minutes worth of us. If you're like, I just can't get enough of this show, I need more of what just happened here. You can listen to ATP Overtime by joining ATP.com/join. This week on Overtime, our topic is our state of TV and cord cutting and streaming services. We're going to go over what we're doing, what we subscribe to, how it's going. You can join us. Listen to ATP.com/join. Thank you so much, everybody. Talk to you next week.
All right, what are we doing post-show?
You got all these after-shows to choose from.
All right, so for the two of you, I think shorter would be a conversation about my confusion about home-related things, or slightly longer would be my confusion about how to write code. Which would you prefer?
I kind of like the coding one, to be honest. But
all right, I should have done a little bit of refreshing on what specifically the issue was. All right, but here we go. Okay, so I have a classical code-related problem that I was curious to get you folks' input on. I was working on something. I had a little bit of a race condition for something I was working on, and suffice to say,
is that like being a little bit pregnant? I've got a little bit of a race condition.
Well, it's fair.
Virtually unique.
It doesn't even matter, really. I had a situation where two completely different classes needed to tell each other that something had happened. So one of them, if I recall correctly, and it doesn't really matter in the grand scheme of things, but one of them was what I call my purchasing manager, which is to say my kind of front end to StoreKit 2. And shoot, I think the other one was my user settings class, which is my front end to user defaults, if you're not familiar. So basically that is the thing that manages payment and in-app purchase and whatnot, and the thing that manages your preferences, right? And the two of them really don't know about each other, generally speaking, and really shouldn't know about each other, generally speaking, but for reasons that are not pertinent for this conversation, one of them needed to inform the other that something had happened.
Things and, you shouldn't understand.
Right? And so what I'd written in our internal show notes was, how do you get two completely different and disconnected classes to talk to each other gracefully? And why is the answer notification center, which is the answer that you typically use on iOS and perhaps macOS. But I don't love that answer. And I was curious if you guys had any tips or tricks that you would advise. And for those who may not understand, notification center is, you two are going to be offended by this description, but it's kind of like a bus that you can not a beep beep bus, like a bus like
a communication bus.
Insofar as it's a messaging bus where you can drop a message on this bus and people can choose to listen to it. That's kind of an oversimplification, but it's like you know, you shout out, hey, something has happened, and if somebody's listening, great, and if nobody's listening, no big deal. And that's generally speaking how people solve this exact problem. But it's like, you know, how do you send a letter from, you know, one address to another without knowing what those addresses are? Like, that's also not a great analogy. I can't think of a better one.
It's a broadcast. Like, you know, the way, because, like, you know, like one class can like vend an API, and the other class can, like, you know, you could do like, you know, a publish subscribe mechanism or a delegation mechanism, but that would require at least one to know about the other, if not bidirectional. So what you're saying, you know, so the function notification center serves is like one class can post a notification, the other class can listen for that notification, and neither one of them has to know anything about the details of the other, as long as the notification itself is documented and known. And notifications, so what makes this a hard problem to do in ways that programmers can swallow with modern sensibilities is that what it requires is globalness.
Yeah.
And programmers today hate anything being global, and with ample reason. Like, in many cases, you don't really want global state or global, you know, protocols or, you know, or global, you know, actors and things.
When Marco says global, what he means by that is everyone can touch this piece of information. And that's, generally speaking, a real bad code smell. It's one of those things where you look and you go, ugh, I don't love that at all.
And not just everybody can touch it, but also, depending on how you do this, it's very easy to get into a situation where you decrease or eliminate modularity. Oh, now I need a second one of these things. Oh, but you can't have a second one because they all talk through this one you know, notification center using a set of name messages. And if any, you can't have two of them. Like if you had some kind of interface where you're like, now I'm going to instance a second one of these and connect to a different server with it. Oh, but when it sends a message that a thing happened, the other one sees it too, because there's one message bus. So no, okay, I'll give them different message buses. I'll prefix their message names. And it's like, you've no longer had it be self-contained, testable, modular, composable in that way. And maybe you don't care. Lots of apps eventually have to say, look, this is my app. I'm not going to clone my entire app to be next to itself in memory at the same time. Although many people have thought that and then found in version 3 that they need to do exactly that. So that's the other smell of the globalness is like the singletonness, right? People don't like globals for good reasons. And some good reasons, people are afraid of singletons because every time they make one 3 years later, they're like, damn it, I wish this wasn't a singleton.
I think though, there are times when global messages and singletons are the best tool for the job in reality. And it's one of those things that programmers so easily overthink and try to, you know, add complexity to get out of when it's not necessary. So, you know, some examples like, and this isn't quite as pure as notifications, but like, you know, in Overcast, I have some utility classes that do things like manage. They have combine publishers, yes.
Yes.
That, because this was before we had async sequences, which I still don't really understand fully or, frankly, like.
I use them. They're nice.
They're fine in some cases. I don't think they're a great overall replacement, but they have some advantages. Anyway, so I'll have a class like my reachability class, which basically will post. It'll publish to a publisher. When in a singleton, you know, OC reachability has a singleton, OC reachability.shared, and it will publish is online publisher. So anything in the app can then, you know, subscribe to OC reachability.shared.is online publisher. And then that thing will get notified when the internet connection becomes online, and it can do things like start a sync operation or whatever. And so that's, so when you have, like, in this case, that's a global object. But the global object, you know, singleton, the global singleton is representing the state of the system, which is a global state. The system is either online or it's not. And so there are opportunities that you have in, you know, in programming where, like, what you are trying to convey, respond to, interact with, is something that is global to the process or the device or the installation of your app or whatever it is. There are global things, and so it's okay to write global code to deal with them much of the time or all the time. And in the case of Notification Center and, you know, like the kind of global bus of passing these messages that are just distinguished by their string names, I don't think there's anything wrong with that for a lot of use cases. Now, granted, the API can be a little bit unswifty, and, you know, it's not ideal.
Not type safe. They're strings. Oh no!
Right, but and it's trivial to make it type safe. Also, and I think that is fine when your problem is what you describe, which is two totally different classes that don't know about each other, that maybe can't like import their modules and can't even reasonably do that. Like, they want to pass global messages within the same process. The tool for that is Notification Center, and I don't think it being old or it not being particularly Swift native is a reason that you have to somehow come up with some kind of different solution. That tool exists and it works great for that purpose. It is not the best tool for every purpose, but it's a great tool for that purpose. So I think the answer is Notification Center.
I don't know if that was the first thing I would reach for, because, like, I don't know the structure of your app, but the two things you describe, things managing user settings and things dealing with store stuff, like, I have to think in the hierarchy of stuff that you already have connected as the sort of the object graph or the responsibility mm-hmm. graph of your thing, there's surely something that is a parent of both of them. You know what I mean? Like, there's, if you don't want to use, I mean, Notification Center is fine. Like, it doesn't matter. It'll be fine. But, like, probably the first thing I would have reached for is, like, what is the common parent for these? Or, like, in Swift UI, often, like, is there some environment injection that's happening above it that they can all see or something like that? Yeah, you can get into trouble real fast there, because that environment is like, it's like globals, but we won't say the G word, so everyone will be happy with it. It's like, okay, all right.
Very true.
But when you have a bunch of objects like this, very often there is there is some party that can see both, and they can, you know, they don't need to know about each other, but they all know about the parent because they're talking to it anyway, or the grandparent or whatever. It all boils down to the same thing in the end. Like, maybe if you had performance concerns, you didn't want to use notification center or a direct call through to a grandparent thing or a common API would be fine. I think the only place I use notification center is because it does, if you're talking about the same API, it also works across processes. Like, because I use it to make front center and switch class talk to each other.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that. I presume it's the same thing. Maybe it's different on Mac OS, actually.
You have to be, like, because of App Store, blah, 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 you got to be in the same app group. And there's all these restrictions on it and everything like that. But it is essentially a free, local, like, I don't even know. I honestly don't even know if it's, like, using Unix sockets under the cover, like, as in, like, not internet sockets, but, like, sockets. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, I honestly have no idea how it's working. But that's just the kind of API I want. And you send messages, small messages between apps, and it's very fast or whatever. But within my app, I always tend to... You know, I don't go the full Java route of, like, dependency injection. You build up this tree of things that don't know about each other, but they all have the things they need to do their work injected into them from above. And that just, I mean, there's a reason that that's, like, a joke. And I guess probably some people who are still working in Java like it, but I think the industry generally agreed that's too far. If you don't know what dependency injection is in Java, be glad. But it's basically
hold on. There, as with all things, there are times when it makes sense, and there's a
But they went overboard, which is like, I mean, it may, like, to Marco's point about globals, like, at some point everyone always has to have them. That's true unless you're writing libraries, and I think a lot of the Java stuff was like, we're writing libraries, everybody's a library author, and so they'd make all these frameworks where it's like, we don't know the things that you're going to use to assemble these, so first build this thing and inject this thing into it and say, okay, you're going to use this for this, and you're going to use this for this, and you're going to use this for this. Okay, now you are going to be the thing that this thing uses for this. And it's just like, before you can do the first thing, you have to assemble these Lego pieces, all of which are interchangeable, which is great for testability. But it's like, man, like, I just want to put up a window and say hello world on it, and I've assembled this tree of 8,000 objects and everything. I mean, anyway,
I mean, I don't know. If you squint, I would say environment object in Swift UI is
oh, no, environment object is much kinder and gentler than all the stuff that gets injected for a lot of the Java. That's more of like an API design issue. But, like, again, within an individual small app, like an app that is not like enterprise scale distributed across thousands of systems, you know, or a Photoshop size app or whatever. That's when I say, you know, talking about a small app within something like that. Yeah, like, everybody's always going to end up having some kind of global state somewhere. And as long as you, like, know where it is and keep a handle on it and you're pretty sure it's not going to screw you over later, or if it does screw you over later, it's not that big a deal to, you know, turn it from, you know, whatever dot OC reachability dot shared, turn it into an instance of that object that gets given to one of the super grandparent objects of all the other things in your object graph. Like, I don't think you need to beat yourself about too much. My only advice would be, do you need to reach for Notification Center, or is there some common ancestor that they can talk through? If it's too inconvenient for the ancestor to talk through, then don't do it. Like, I don't think there's anything wrong with using Notification Center unless it's a performance issue. But
so as it turns out, as I was reaching for Notification Center, I realized, wait a second, past KC was either an idiot or a genius, depending on how you look at it. And the purchasing manager class was aware of the user settings class. It didn't have like a copy of it or anything, but there were a couple of functions that would take an instance of user settings as a parameter. And so that meant, all right, I've already, you know, unzipped my fly, if you will. So I went to the grandparent.
Oh, oh God.
What? All right, never mind. All right,
why?
I'll start over.
No!
I'll start over. I thought it was funny. All right, never mind. I'll start it all over. I'll give you an edit point. Jesus Christ. All right.
Are you peeing in this metaphor or something
with
else?
With your grandparents?
I'm not even sure. I don't... All right, with grandparents, it does fall apart real quick, doesn't it? All right, this is a mess.
Oh, my
God.
All
right, now we need to reboot it. Okay. See, bootleg people, this is a gift from us to you. Happy holidays, happy Hanukkah, Merry Christmas, et cetera, et cetera. All right, let me reboot that whole damn thing. So it's funny you bring up, you know, the whole grandparent thing, because when I was doing this and I was reaching for Notification Center, I realized, wait a second, I already have a function or two in the purchasing manager that takes an instance of user settings as a parameter. So purchasing manager is aware of the existence of user settings anyway, which means PassKC was either a genius or an idiot, depending on how you want to look at it.
Why are you passing it as a parameter? If you've only got one purchasing manager in your app and you only got one set of settings, and I would imagine the purchasing manager might need to look at your settings because there might be settings that are relevant to the purchasing manager. But either way, it seems like the purchasing manager could be instantiated with access to settings or use, you know, a singleton for settings or whatever. It's like Margaret was saying, how many composable sets of settings do you expect to have?
Yeah, that is fair. But the moral of the story, though, that is that I realized, oh, wait, one of them already knows about the other. User settings does not know about purchasing manager, if I recall correctly. Actually, I'm not even sure that's true, but it doesn't matter. But I can tell you for certainty the purchasing manager knows about user settings. And so then I thought, okay, well, somewhere I'm building both of these objects, just as you were saying, John. And I went back to, you know, the grandfather of the grandfather, if you will.
I wasn't really suggesting that you thread down references to each other. What I was suggesting is that there's something that is managing both user settings and the purchasing manager, and that thing coordinates the behavior, not that you shove user settings down into the purchasing manager and they know about each other directly. But it's just like, you know, composability. You're responsible for this tiny region. You're responsible for this tiny thing. And then above you is a thing that's responsible for the larger region. It uses you two to do its job. It is like dependency injection, only it's not injectable pieces. You're just statically assembling the tree of stuff, but whatever.
Yeah. But either way, the point is it ended up being easier than I thought, but I thought it was an interesting discussion that the three of us could have, because I didn't know if there was some, you know, architecture astronaut approach that I wasn't aware of.
There's an infinite number.
But I think we're saying you probably don't need to reach for them in this case.
Yeah. Like space, architecture astronauts have infinite possibilities. It also does not mean you should use almost any of them.
And again, those patterns are much more appropriate for people designing libraries and frameworks, because you can't know how people are going to use them. And if you make decisions, like I just saw something about user defaults saying, like, if you set up user defaults with a suite name and you configure default values for settings, defaults for defaults, but you set it on the suite name, you're also setting it for everything that's not the suite name, unbeknownst to you, and of course undocumented. So when you create a user setting without a suite name and you try to get a value, it's like, looks like somebody already said it. No, you just already said it when you set the default for the suite name, because they don't, whatever singleton they're using, they don't divide it up by suite namespace for the defaults, and it's undocumented. So when you're a library author, you got to be real careful about that, because you can't make those assumptions. Like, well, there'll only ever be one of these, and you know, that comes back to bite you. But for an individual app, you should know how many of each of the thing there are going to be in your app. You're not vending your app's code as a library for the entire world to use.
Exactly. So anyway, I appreciate you talking me through it, and it sounds like I don't need to be such a stickler about these sorts of
things. Sorry to the non-developers. This was a little bit nerdy.
Yeah, sorry, everybody. All right, titles.
I love Institutionally Inescapable.
I like it.
What was that from?
You, John.
About Apple, right?
It was near the end of the Apple ID kind of discussion that these companies are institutionally inescapable.
I remember saying it. Let's see. I wish my family was more impressed by my TV. That's a Rectiff's title, but it's true.
That's my number two. Title. It's a little long, but I do like that.
I do love that one. I like it more than
It doesn't capture the bitter spirit of the episode like Institutionally Inescapable does, though.
I think it kind of does.
Or not peeing with grandparents.
We're not doing that yet. Sorry.
or the other thing with grandparents.
All right. Jesus Christ.
Oh, my God.
I guess Inescapable is probably the best one.
Sure. That gets my vote.
All right.
Going in the robot. All right. Vamp for a second while I do this. When do we publish our recording, rather, next? Monday?
Yeah, Monday.
Monday.
Yeah, because obviously Christmas week next week, so we're recording the regular show on Monday instead of Wednesday, so the 22nd. So thank you, thank you, live people. We will talk to you on Monday. I guess bootleg people technically will also talk to you on Monday. But anyway, bye, live people. We're going into overtime. See you.
Yep. All right, bye, everybody.